on blast, which is exciting. And if I tell you any of the results, I'll have to kill you. So, so we won't talk about that at all. I have the pointer.
Okay. That's what I was looking for.
What? Did you work on the GRO?
No, I was in the same lab when it was.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, Pamela is a small satellite that was launched in Italy, and they have some interesting results. And I thought I would read you a little quote here. This, and they're talking about their result on positrons, which we'll talk about. This would have implications for various beyond the standard research and for cosmology. Maps of the dark matter clouds in and around clusters of galaxies have been made using weak gravitational lensing. We see this and we can map it, but so far we didn't get any confirmed signals from it. So the if the rumor checks out, it could be a first. This was posted on one of these blogs. Somebody calling themselves Pamela posted at It's Not Even Wrong blog. So I was amused by that. Anyway, let's see. I thought I would say a little bit about cosmic rays so you have some context for why these measurements were even being done in the first place. There's a recent measurement by the measurement is actually 2 or 3 years old by this Attic balloon payload that's looking at high energy electrons and nuclear composition. Hess has recently purported some electron spectral measurements that will be important in looking at these results. And then I'll talk about Pamela. I'm gonna disconnect your cord here. Maybe if you go over there, I'm less likely to either kill myself or unplug your computer. So the cosmic ray spectra here, these are protons, helium. They're throughout the periodic table, as you know. This spectrum is extremely steep, and if electrons were on here, they would be at about 1/100th of these protons, and even steeper. So those are a very steep spectra that's hard to make measurements on them. And the cosmic ray abundances are similar in general terms to the solar system, which is this blue. The cosmic rays are filled in with these lighter nuclei, which are absent in the universal abundances. That filling in is due to the spallation reactions of these guys as they're flying around the galaxy, interacting with gas and dust there, and making these filling in these valleys. And by studying that, you can figure out how much material the cosmic rays have gone through. And it turns out one particular way to do this is measuring the boron to carbon ratio, and that ratio falls with increasing energy. And this tells you something about the time that the cosmic rays can live inside the galaxy. They escape out with, and this falls at about e to the minus half, and that'll be become important in a bit. You can also study radioactive isotopes and their abundances as a function of energy. The fractional survival gives you some kind of lifetime for cosmic rays in the galaxy of about greater than 10 to the 7th years. Now, if the particles just were, they're all at basically going at velocity c, so if they left the galaxy in straight lines, they would leave the galaxy in 10 to the 4 years or so. So this implies that cosmic rays are diffusively trapped in the galaxy by magnetic scattering. And the argument is very straightforward. So the energy density requirements for cosmic rays is about 1 EV, they are about 1 EV per cubic centimeter as measured locally, and this implies the galaxy has this luminosity of a little over 41, 10 to the 41 ergs per second. Supernova per explosion releases something a bit over 10 to the 51st ergs per second, and they happen at maybe one every 30 years, maybe a little less frequently, and that gives you an energy input is the which is probably the only one that's large enough to supply this luminosity for the galaxy. And so that's been long known as circumstantial evidence that supernova were the origin, and the acceleration process has to be quite efficient, 10%, and if these are one every 100 years, even 30% efficient to convert energy into cosmic rays.
Sorry, what's the energy density due to just the stellar material in the galaxy? I'm not familiar with the units.
Well, let's see, a comparable... This is all in... We're not talking about stars. We're talking about cosmic rays in between stars. The magnetic field energy density is about the same. This may be no accident because the pressure balances is probably natural. It's about the energy density in starlight.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, and just near the plane of the galaxy. So it's... Now, we sit here and we observe this. We don't really know what the source spectrum is. We sit here and we observe this with an index of 2.7. I showed you this secondaries to primaries, this falling off at about 0.6 power in this escape length here. And so the source spectrum is probably something like this minus... So somewhere between 2.1 and 2.4 is probably the spectrum at the source. So if you think about electrons now, electrons will be modified from this source spectrum by their losses due to inverse Compton and synchrotron radiation in the galactic magnetic field. So the expected spectrum of electrons should probably be about one power steeper than this, something a little between, a little steeper than three. And so that's going to be the background on which we see this measurement made by Attic. Oops. And just because I can't resist... I personally have been working on this experiment called BEST, Balloon Experiment with a Superconducting Solenoid. This is a very large payload. This is the cross-section. We're looking for antiprotons, which we see in this band here on a plot of rigidity versus inverse velocity. Here's protons. Here's antiprotons. Here's deuterium, a little bit of tritium. And we measure this. This is a warm bore solenoid that we fill with a tracking chamber. This whole size here is 2 meters long and a little over a meter in diameter. So it's a very large payload that we fly on balloons. And many years ago now, this is an old plot now, but we did make a little bite into this phase space of parameters that were disallowed because we didn't see any evidence for any antiprotons from decay of or annihilations of WIMP particles. So we were able to set a little limit. That's an old sort of historical thing at this point. But the best payload is generally launched in the summer in Antarctica. A high-pressure cell sets up here, and the payloads are launched from McMurdo here, and they circumnavigate the pole. They stay in daylight the whole time, so you have solar power all the time, and they can allow you to get many, many day balloon flights, as opposed to the typical balloon flights that we've had for many, many years, which are a day or so in So this has been a fantastic new development and allowed us to get high statistics measurements for the first times. This is our result from best polar flight in 2004, December 2004. And here are is again this plot with the different positively charged isotopes, and then here's antiprotons, and the little background of singly charged relativistic particles, muons and pions. And so we've been able to measure the spectrum of antiprotons fairly accurately, and this is another secondary produced particle from the collisions of the cosmic rays as they go through the matter in the galaxy. And this is placing a fairly tight constraint on models of propagation of cosmic rays. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm a little uninitiated.
Yeah.
Can you help me understand the axes on the plot on the left?
Okay, so here's rigidity. So zero rigidity has infinite bending. You got no geometry factor right here, okay? They just curve right up. Now, as the rigidity goes up, the particles become more and more relativistic, so the velocity approaches 1, okay? And different isotopes of hydrogen have a different track on this plot.
Got it.
And so this is inverse velocity here.
That I see. So the rigidity is basically the amount of bending that you see in your solenoid chamber.
Right. It's the inverse of the curvature in the magnetic field. And so then positive bending and negative bending separate the charge of particles.
What's the deuteron fraction? Just out of
curiosity. This here? I don't have that in my head. I have a plot I could look up where... We actually are placing limits on the anti-deuterium, which are starting to, if we could get another couple orders of magnitude, we could begin to probe black holes. And that may actually, when AMS flies, may provide the best limit on some of these annihilations and decays too. But this fraction doesn't violate anything relative to universal abundances or anything. No, it's not. There's nothing particularly significant about it. Some of this is produced in the atmosphere above as well. So these tritium are coming from the collisions. You have about 5 grams per square centimeter of residual atmosphere above, and some of the proton, some of the helium can be interacting and making these guys. So the point of sort of developing that case is to bring this plot in. This is the Pamela result on antiprotons to protons. And here is the best data over here. The reason people take this ratio is because this is important to modulation effects. As cosmic rays try to come into the solar system, they're swimming upstream essentially against the solar wind that is convecting magnetic fields out and pushing the particles away. And this is charge sign dependent, and you see it here in the ratio. The data from one phase of the solar cycle are up here and another phase are down here, and we'll come back to that. But the Pamela data that are on the antiprotons above 10 GeV are constraining some of these models for dark matter.
I guess the error bars are statistical only?
Yeah.
So what's roughly, it used to be the old bugaboo about multiple scattering of positively charged protons looking like antiprotons.
Those systematics are off scale here. They would be important in looking at the very highest rigidities, but their MDR is over here somewhere. The maximum detectable momentum. Yeah, I don't know that. Well, that may be, these bins are selected to get reasonable air bars. So here's cosmic ray data now on electrons and positrons. I have to be careful because I have to, oftentimes I use the term electrons to refer to the sum of these two components where we cannot separate them out. So if there's any confusion, be sure to ask. But these are spectra of what's known about electrons until quite recently. So this is where we are. The positron fraction of the total electron population is about a tenth. So you'll see that in these fluxes. Now, the electrons are thought to be primarily primaries, accelerated at the sources, but this very steep spectrum, as you recall I mentioned, this is above, up around e to the minus 3 here, and these positrons are probably secondaries mostly that are produced again by collisions of protons as they go through the galaxy. So that's kind of the, in a sense, that's the background for the dark matter signature. Now, this is ADEC. ADEC is the first experiment I'm going to talk about. It's flown on a balloon. It weighs 2,000 or 3,000 kilograms. It's a calorimeter, basically, with layers of orthogonal logs of BGO. There's a target up above, which is graphite. That's about, I think that's about a quarter of a radiation length in each of these target sections. So, sort of three, interaction length. Sorry, a quarter of an interaction length, and then there's tracking devices between these. These P2, P3, P4 are charged particle tracking with scintillating fibers, and on top. Now, these calorimeters like this have been flown for a long time. Electron studies are difficult with them because, first of all, the protons are 100 times more abundant, the electron spectra are steeper, and one of the things that was found is you get a lot of backsplash from the showers developing in the calorimeter. They go back and they screw up the charge measurement of what's coming in. So what you have to do to get rid of this is divide and conquer, basically. So the incoming detector used to be just monolithic planes of some kind of ionization detector. Now they're made of arrays of silicon detectors to cover this, so you can see in a very isolated area what was the incoming charge. And so that's how this works. There's lots of details, but you can see the geometric factor depends on exactly the sets of detectors, but it's somewhere between a quarter and a half of a square meter steradian. And this opening angle here is 24. Okay, so now ADEC flew. This is a simulated event. They do a lot of Monte Carlo simulations. They take a long time even with the modern techniques. And you can see stuff is going everywhere. And so what you're basically doing is adding up all this energy here. And so they measure an electron spectrum. They try to identify the electrons and pull out that spectrum, and these were two different measurements, and they got these curves here. Note that this e to the cubed here is to flatten this out so you can see. And the interesting thing here is this so-called bump. These are, as I've been saying, these are tough measurements. Here comes the background. Now suppose we've underestimated that a little bit, and that's what makes these experiments so difficult.
So what is this background?
Protons faking an electron. Yeah.
What are the two different data points for?
These two sets?
Yeah.
They're two different flights.
I see.
One was shorter than the other. One was about 8 days. One was 25 days, something like that. And so the shorter one has these higher error bars. These tighter error bars are from the longer one. And they can combine them, and they've just published this in Nature. And here is superimposed is a theoretical background based on these cosmic ray propagation models. And so there's this interesting bump. And you can see the old data here. These black points were taken using nuclear emulsions, where they had to track the showers in an emulsion, and they're hard measurements. Now they're finally beginning to get this. If it's right, it's quite interesting. I don't know, there's this sort of double hump structure, if that's real, but if you go back here, you'll see there's a little bit of a phase, a little bit of energy shift here.
And they plot the symbols so you can't see the error bars?
They're just smaller than
that. Yeah, they're right. The statistics are... out here, you see, the error bars are getting big. But down in here, they're pretty good statistics.
Another question?
Yes.
Can you go to the next plot?
Yeah. Sorry, you're over on the... keep out of here.
So how robust is the theoretical prediction for the background? Mm-hmm. Is it normalization and slope?
Well, it's based on a model. And theorists are clever guys. But
presumably, if you just change the slope a little bit, I mean, the significance of your signal will go down quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. No, right. And what the truth is, I mean, certainly something, you know, that's more or less straight through there.
Yeah.
Is, now, we do expect that up here, above a TEV, that synchrotron losses are so fast that the cosmic rays probably cannot diffuse very fast from their sources to reach us. So these electrons will, up in this energy range, if they're true, they are coming from very nearby sources. And one of the motivations to look in this energy range is to see if you can see with good statistics structure from individual sources here in these spectra. So that's sort of the cosmic ray motivation of this. And that kind of could produce little bumps here in this spectrum.
So just to build on the question he was asking a second ago, I mean, are Attic happy with this theoretical prediction? I mean, because...
It's just a standard simple model.
I see. Yeah.
I think I don't know if I brought it, but I think I have somewhere a chart I can show you with some individual sources plotted on here. So Vela, Gamingo, they can show up, and they tend to show up more at these higher energies. And the curves tend to go, for an individual source, tends to go up like that and then down. And the down part is well understood by synchrotron losses. And the normalization here depends on how far away they are and stuff.
I can comment on the curve. So the nature of this curve, as I understand it, comes from this program called Galprop, which is from Moskalenko and Strong. The way in which this works is that they take an assumed injection spectrum sort of universally throughout, you know, the region of near us. And I think it's e to the minus 2.4.5 or something like that. So that's an assumed injection of electrons, and then they propagate it in their model, which accounts for energy losses and such things, and then they generate this curve. But the actual assumed injection of 2.5 is just something that they had put in a long time ago to fit the then experimental data on electrons, which, you know, as we saw, was sort of, you know, falling at some power law.
Right.
E to minus 3.
And that's why I mentioned that we don't really know the source spectrum.
Precisely. So really, this curve is completely arbitrary. In other words, that you can move this around at will just by choosing this injection.
At will is a little strong, I would say. You can change this slope by 0.2, maybe, max.
No, you can change it much more than that.
I don't.
No, I mean, in the sense that, that there is no theory that goes into this number. That's an assumed number that's put in from the beginning. And it was put in a long time ago to match data, not because they had a theory for where the electrons...
Well, shock acceleration theory says that if you will produce a spectrum at the source, which is e to the minus 2 to 2.2.
Right, but that, but
and that fits with this whole picture. That's why I say it's not
but,
totally...
But that only fits the protons because that goes up to about e to the minus 2.7, 2.8.
Yeah.
Whereas the electrons is steeper, right?
The electrons is steeper, but for a well-understood reason, and that's the synchrotron losses. So the electron spectrum is assumed in all this. It is an assumption that the acceleration mechanism produces the same spectrum for protons and electrons.
But the injection that was used to create this is different for nuclei than for electrons.
No.
Yes.
I don't think so.
You're saying that is a statement that you're saying that you assume the acceleration mechanism produces the same spectrum, and then you put in standard synchrotron radiation, you get the electron spectrum.
Right.
So there's really just one assumption, which is the injection. Which is a common injection.
That's what I'm saying.
But
yes.
To change this curve, then you'd also have to change the proton curve. That's why you're saying this is rigid; you can't change it.
Right.
But you're saying, well, maybe we don't.
Well, what's uncertain between the observed proton spectrum and the source spectrum is the spectrum of the secondaries. Because that's that delta factor that I showed back there. That constrains the difference between the going from observed to primary, source spectrum, I mean. And that, there's a lot of, that'd be a whole nother discussion in itself. But I mean, you're sort of right, but I disagree with some of your details.
the statement is very simple. It's just that there are two injected spectra in the program that was used to compute this line, and those numbers are different. They're not the same injected spectrum. There may be rationale for why they should be similar.
Yeah.
And I'm not speaking to that.
Well, you have a model. It's Galprop is just a model.
Right.
And you can put in whatever you want to
exactly.
be variable in that model.
But then as a consequence,
that doesn't mean it's
line.
Physical or
exactly.
theoretical.
That's right, but as a consequence, the slope of the line is a free parameter.
No,
that's all it's not.
It cannot. This is such a naive because Galprop does not only take into account measurements of the electrons and proton spectra. It's a self-consistent model that maps, for instance, synchrotron radiation in the radio foreground of the galaxy, which are due to electrons. It maps, it takes into account the red Schrödinger emission, gamma rays, and all of these things are cross-correlated. So you cannot vary, for instance, that injection spectral index at ease because you screw up gamma rays as observed by Egret. Just to mention one, so it's a cross correlation, and the secondaries that you produce are correlated with the primaries. So
well, when we talked to Moloseko himself, he said that you cannot simultaneously fit all possible things at once, even with his own code. In other words, there is no one best set of input parameters that match everything.
Right, but they're not totally free either.
They're not totally free, but what I'm saying is that the extent to which you trust this line, that it's not tilted in one way or another.
Well, you could easily find a model that's consistent with all the data that would put this straight. But you can't make it like that. That's the point.
Well, anyway, you wouldn't want to because
yeah.
the data doesn't.
Right.
So, can I ask you a question
yeah.
just about these data
yeah.
points? I mean, you're measuring electron energy in this detector.
Yes.
Does their energy calibration come from shooting electrons of known energy in?
Yes.
Oh, good.
CERN. Yeah.
Great.
Calibration at CERN.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And here is what this little bump looks like on the spectrum. Here it's. Even multiplied by E squared, but this is just another view of it. Also, let's see, there is another balloon experiment, that tends to show a little excess at this same, around the same energy.
What's that other balloon experiment?
Betts, it's a group in Japan, Shoji Tori is the leader of that group. I don't guess I left a reference here, but conference was at Waseda University, where Tori is
from.
Yeah. There's a very few data points. Now, GLAST is going to be able to make a measurement, very, very good measurement right in this energy range. So we should, within a year, GLAST will have an excellent measurement in this range. It can either confirm or not this experiment. Now Hess recently has published a paper. This is the air shower experiment, and they can find electromagnetic showers, as you know, from all their gamma ray measurements. And they've made a measurement of the electrons, and they see this very steep fall off here that's expected from the synchrotron. I've forgotten exactly the numbers, but they put a constraint on any nearby source within a kilo, stronger than a certain amount within a kiloparsec. So this general tendency of the electrons to fall off here is very well confirmed by these Hess measurements.
And the fall off mechanism doesn't push the electrons to lower energy. Wait, should I be?
There's so damn few of them, though. That once, if an electron here suddenly appears over here, it's lost.
It doesn't yeah. give you a
peacework. Right.
How does Hess also detect electrons?
They try to go off source and look, and they do a very good job of getting rid of hadron showers, and so these are just electromagnetic showers. If they're isotropically background, they assume they're electrons.
So it's an upper limit, not a.
These are not limits there. Their data, their measurement, flux measurements.
But they say there could be 50% contamination from gammas to be systematic. Do they assume 10% contamination from gammas? It could be as much as 50%. I don't know if that's included in the other.
Yeah, I think it's in the systematic error. That was a great band.
This band is their measurement of uncertainty of energy. And because the spectrum is so steep and they multiply by this E cubed, a measurement of energy of 15% has pretty large error bars when you convert it to this flux. So that is the system, that's what this whole shaded band is.
So when it comes to interpreting this in terms of dark matter, if the mass of the dark matter were high, then we'd get excesses out of this tail that you're now saying is really
raised. Well, if you got some dark matter that's producing electrons above a TeV, it has to be very close to the solar system. It has to be within a kiloparsec. Otherwise it radiates all its energy. And you get out your synchrotron telescope. But this edge here is quite characteristic, so that edge should be at the mass of whatever it is, and then that can be dispersed in energy to lower energies by energy loss processes and stuff. So this could fit with a mass of about 600 or so. All right, and this is the whole, I beat this horse to death here, I guess, with these curves, but this has got sort of for reference more specifically the exact data points. Now let's turn to the positron fraction. This is the situation as of a few years ago. The positrons this is the positron fraction in the cosmic rays. These are some theoretical curves. And there was some hints that as you got above several GeV, you began to have an excess of positrons. And there's a lot of debate in the community, well, is that just background coming in? Because if you had background problems with electrons, boy, have you got them with positrons. Because now you've got the same sign of bending in a magnetic spectrometer, and you got another order of magnitude of protons. So you got, so these measurements here were all kind of, well, you know, when we get really good spectrometers and more statistics, that'll sort itself out.
When you say excess, you just mean relative to that solid line?
Relative to this solid line, right.
How unreasonable are the dash dot and the dash curves then?
Well, these were some particular models.
Yeah.
One of the things that was mentioned in this paper is positrons from pulsars. And I think one of these curves, I forget which one, is due to an excess of just positrons from a nearby pulsar.
So you really need to postulate other sources to
make this
in any way.
Yeah, the galactic cosmic rays, you can argue again about the details, but they roughly follow this curve. Down below this energy, I'll show you in a minute, there's a lot of solar modulation effects. So
you could just draw a straight line through all that, and it would fit within the error bars, so I just change the slope a little bit. Yeah. Not, I don't mean flat, I mean just a straight power law line.
Yeah. Well, this is blind watchers of the sky. This is people looking at the at the few sigma effects and trying to, you know, do what they can with them. But they mention not only possible dark matter signatures here, but they mentioned many other possible sources of this excess. So here's the Pamela experiment. I guess most of you have seen this. It has a relatively small geometry factor. Here's incoming trigger detectors. The EDXs are measured here. You have the magnetic spectrometer, and then you have an imaging calorimeter down here, and I'll show you some pictures later on of events. And here's their measured positron fraction. Here was their particular version of this theoretical curve. Here are their data. The first time this data was presented in a conference, and somebody took a photograph. Maybe you've all heard the story. And took a photograph. They presented data up to here in written papers, but this rising part here was only shown in conferences. So theorists grabbed a photograph of this, went and reconstructed and there were papers in the literature before this data was even published. So here it is relative to all these other measurements. This part down here I'm going to come back to and try to explain why this is different. It has to do with the sign of the charge and the solar modulation. But this is pretty clear, convincing evidence that something is rising here. And it's the fraction of positrons in this secondary component. And here, I just put this here because it's got some references to different models. Here was the data, the first form of their public presentation of these data. They were quite cautious. And then here's a whole bunch of models and stuff. So when you have a copy of this, you can have this for reference for those papers. And I showed you this before, and this comes back in. This is the antiprotons, and this actually constrains these models, because if you have a model that produces both both positrons and antiprotons, these antiproton measurements constrain. This is an example. This paper here.
So if you
produce too many, if you have this. Whatever model you have that produces this can also produce rising antiprotons, and so you have to check both.
Right, and what about the electrons? I mean, is this contribution too small to affect the
this contribution
the total electron plus positron spectrum that you showed before.
Okay, now this, suppose you had a model, let's see, this is 100 and this is a TeV. So if you had a model that went up like this and then died here, some 600 GeV mass particle, and then produced antiprotons that met this constraint, you've satisfied everything. Mm-hmm. But the constraint would be that this would have this this fall off at a TeV.
Right, so the orange model is...
The orange model is kind of is ruled out
by the electron.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this rise in the antiprotons in the positrons is very steep. It requires a positron component with a hard spectrum to go up that fast, to have that ratio rise that fast, because it's a mix of the background positrons and the from galactic cosmic rays and whatever this other source is. So let's see. In fact, that would see a hardening of the spectrum in the or any measurement of the electron in the energy range 100 to 1,000 GeV. So the attic feature is inconsistent with this particular model, but not other possible models. This model was a very specific model that produced a mass of a particle around 10 TeV. That chart was really from a different presentation. Now let me come back to this modulation and what's going on in the positrons down here. Why are these so different? From all, and does that mean we don't have confidence somehow in the positron measurement? So if you look now, remember I was showing you this antiproton to proton ratio and comparing it with this positron, and I said this was due to the this jump here at low energies is due to the solar modulation. And the solar field reverses, and I'll show you another plot and what happens, but when the solar field reverses, there's a charge sign dependent effect. As the drift of these low energy particles, the cross field drift is taken into account. And so let's see. In fact, let's go ahead. Yeah, here's a little model. This is the sun at the middle, and this is what's called the neutral current sheet between the solar dipole. As it flows out from the sun, dragged out by the solar wind, and the sun rotates, and you get this ballerina skirt effect. Now, of course, the Earth is going in and out of these different regions, but generally speaking, the solar field has a sort of dipole effect, and this neutral current sheet, if you plot along this way, has got this kind of wavy structure. So it was very confusing at first when first observations were made, because the Earth is going around in and out of these different sheets, and so the sign was reversing and everything. But if you organize this depending on the solar dipole structure, you get a period when this potential is greater than zero and less than zero. It's just the sign of the solar field. And in one case, positive particles diffuse in over the pole and reach the ecliptic through this way, whereas in the other phase, they have to come across this way, and they have to diffuse around and go out that way. And it's a second-order effect, but it's important, and what it does is modulates, as a function of time, this ratio. And for p-bars, it's this jumping up, and if you take electrons, it jumps down. And that's why this low-energy modulate... Whoops. That's why this reverses sign, and that's why these went down. Plus, they're much more accurate measurements than were ever made before.
Now, are these corrected for altitude? Well, presumably, you have a few grams of atmosphere. So
no, Pamela, these are balloon measurements.
Right.
This is a satellite. No corrections needed.
So, no, but the balloon measurements.
Yes, yeah, they correct for the altitude. It doesn't change energy very much, but it does. You do have to correct for the gain and loss of particles.
The fraction quite a bit, though.
No, it's a very, because this is 5 grams of residual atmosphere. The
right.
Proton interaction length is whatever it is, 70, something like that. So it's in air. So no, it's not a significant factor.
So could that be corrected for?
It is. Yeah, it's corrected for. I don't remember the magnitude of this correction, but it's small.
If I had a 10 GB electron, I'd put that into 5 grams. Positrons coming out the other side. Right?
Yeah.
I was
but those measurements are made above the atmosphere. These are anti-proton.
If you're comparing it, I was just saying the ones that are comparing the balloon satellite has a systematic in it.
It does. Yeah. It's in these measurements. They're corrected for that effect. It's not a large correction.
No, I was asking about the solar.
These error bars way dominated by just statistical. So, sorry?
I was asking about the solar modulation. I mean, why isn't that corrected for?
This was a plot that was used to demonstrate the effect existed. And you can see it's tough measurement. I mean, the statistics here
is the low energy Pamela data, once you do the correction, it's totally consistent. Is that the thing?
Yeah. Well, the point, if you make the expected, this effect is complicated. I mean, I showed you a simple diagram of how it works, but there's a lot of modeling and stuff in the exact amount of that. The quantitative nature of that is not well understood.
Now, these are a limited period of time for the balloon ones, too, so presumably the solar weather would have some effect also.
Yeah, right.
There was neutron flare.
Right. For these guys in particular, you know, they're integrating over a year, and things in the solar field change a lot on that time scale. Because this whole pattern rotates with a period of 27 days.
How high did Pamela fly?
Pamela is in low Earth orbit. Mm-hmm. It's it's something like 380 kilometers to 600 kilometers orbit above the surface of the Earth.
Does it have any activation problems? Oh, sorry, this is going to be too
difficult. Activation problems? probably. So if they were trying to study gamma rays, I would worry. Yeah, this stuff, right. This is way above the activation photon energy. So, let's see. This is now, I show this mostly to give you some confidence in the Pamela data. This is the positron to electron ratio. It's not published yet, but this is at low energy, at lower energy, and these are the positron to electrons entrapped in the Earth's magnetic field. So these are albedo particles from cosmic rays hitting the atmosphere and making stuff that's quasi-trapped. AMS was the first to study this. Here's AMS data. Here's their Pamela data on the same thing. It's amazing. The east-west effect, which where the Earth's magnetic field focuses the cosmic rays to be maximum from the west because of their bending in the Earth's magnetic field. So the magnetic cutoff is lower in the west. That actually ends up when cosmic rays are coming from the west through the atmosphere, they make positrons which go up and electrons which go down, and that creates a positron excess in the trapped particles in the Earth's magnetic field near the equator. And so this just confirmed that they were measuring things properly and getting that right ratio, or at least it, well, anyway, it agrees and is improvement on AMS's measurement. Now, just to sort of show you the instrument and how it performs a little bit, here's their magnetic spectrometer where they measure the bending. This was an antiproton that went right through the calorimeter. Down here at the bottom is a neutron counter. The proton didn't interact. Now, it's easy to get rid of. And here's an antiproton. This one's kind of cute. Comes in, stops, annihilates, and makes a couple of prongs. That's a very characteristic signature. Now here's a proton, because all the reason I show you this is this all has to do with, can they really separate this positrons from protons, the protons as a background in their positron. So here's a typical proton interacting, spewing stuff at all over the calorimeter, relatively speaking. Here's an electron shower or a positron shower. Higher energy, more tightly constrained, and you can measure both the shower profile and the lateral dispersion of these extra hits in the calorimeter to help separate between protons. But, of course, suppose a proton comes in, a much higher energy proton, just happens to have its make a leading pi zero right here. The rest of the stuff goes out without interacting. The leading pi zero makes this nice electromagnetic cascade. Looks exactly like an electron. That's the background problem for these measurements. And you can sort of make a back of the envelope calculation of what the background rejection requirements are. The proton to positron flux ratio at a couple of hundred GeV is 2 × 10⁴. Because the positrons from one of these interactions I just described shows up at a factor of 3 to 10 lower energy, that gives you a factor of 30 gain in this rejection. Because the radiation length of this very high Z material out of which the calorimeter is made, you got 20 radiation lengths for every interaction length, and it must interact near the top of the calorimeter, so that gives you this. A small fraction of the interactions themselves make these pi zeros, maybe 1%. Maybe you may get some neutrons too. But anyway, all these factors say that in this design of this instrument, you need this kind of rejection. So 10⁵ rejection is not implausible from this kind of calorimeter approach. Does that make sense? Yeah.
We're kind of getting up towards the lunch hour.
Yeah.
So I would just suggest that maybe you find a natural
point
and we continue after lunch.
Let's just pick up right here after lunch, because here I was going to sort of step through how they do on these various...
So if you don't know where the...
Some detail as to what they actually did. This is for a reasonably high rigidity where things should be beginning to get bad, although not the highest. We just show it as a example. So they look at the fraction of charge released along the calorimeter track. This is basically the longitudinal profile of the cascade. Electrons stick up quite prominently, whereas the antiprotons are not too much of a background, but when you get down here to protons, positrons are not visible. And so non-interacting protons, of course, just go through over here. Then they add constraints on the energy in the calorimeter and the momentum. This is a quite powerful constraint because they can measure the bending in the magnet and then the energy deposited. For electrons, it's always pretty close, and whereas for protons, there's a big dispersion in that. And so then positrons begin to jump out at you. And now they add a starting point for the shower and the longitudinal profile of the shower, cuts on those parameters, and you begin to, now you just have a little shoulder of residual protons. And that's where they are. They make a correction, I guess, for what is left over here.
What is the acceptance after that?
The
rejection was 10 to 5. And the acceptance
is? The acceptance is 20 meter squared, 20 centimeter squared to radian.
Sorry, the efficiency is what I meant.
The efficiency? When they're all done. I don't know that number. That's a good question. Yeah. Yeah, well, they're cutting off here in the end, and that, relative to this Gaussian, you can sort of guesstimate. So the explanation for this whole positron excess, it requires a source with a hard spectrum, close to e to the minus 2. If it's dark matter, it needs corroborating evidence because there's a lot of possible sources. Of course, that stimulates a lot of interest. But I think we really have to be careful to reject other explanations first for this. And this was a summary made just for this particular measurement itself. And other possible sources, nearby supernova remnants, primarily they give off electrons, but pulsars are really pair-making machines, so you could easily have... So what you need is a mixture of something with an electron-to-positron ratio near equal in order to show this rising positrons. And many of these pulsars might be close by or well-connected magnetically to the Earth, so that's something that needs to be taken account of. For example, Geminga is probably one of the more likely ones. Its distance is 4/10 of a kiloparsec. Here's some other supernova remnants where these things are expected to contribute to the source of local cosmic ray electrons in a generic sense, as in the attic result. And here I think I mentioned before that I would show something like this. You remember this? Now here's a TeV on this energy scale, so these measurements are maybe a more complete compendium of all the measurements that have been made in electrons over the years. So this goes back a little ways. But here's individual sources. For example, Vela, Cygnus Loop, other possible supernova nearby. And they all have this characteristic fall off at high energy. It just depends on how near it is and the age of it as to where that edge will be. But there are, the fact that Hess is seeing this drop-off here is putting strong constraints on the amount of electrons we can be getting from Vela. Here's a whole list.
Maximum energies that are determined?
Excuse me?
Where do the maximum energies in the modeling?
In these modelings come from? That's the synchrotron loss cutoff. You've got a certain age and a diffusion. You assume a diffusion coefficient, and they just can't. The electrons higher than whatever this cutoff is just don't live long enough for them to diffuse to us. And so here's a list of nearby pulsars. This guy is only 140 parsecs from us. 150, 300, and so on. So there are nearby...
Can I ask a related question?
Yeah.
So pulsars, do they generate equal amounts of, obviously, electron positron?
Probably. They have these pair plasma winds.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a pulsar expert.
Right. Let's just assume
but,
they do.
But particularly in models where they have sources of acceleration of particles near the surface, and those particles, high energy, have to follow the curvature of the field to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And though there's pair production along that magnetic curvature. And so they tend to make plasmas that are equal positrons and electrons.
Okay. Someone has probably already thought of this, but there's got to be some expected sources of electrons by themselves.
Pulsars
have to contribute in pairs, then is there still an excess after you...
These are thought to produce primarily electrons.
Oh, I see.
These supernova remnants.
Right.
They're the sort of classical sources of cosmic
right.
rays. And the acceleration, they pick up whatever charged particles there are in the injection and accelerate them.
Do people put lower limits then on the observed electron?
Well, that's more or less what's being done in this figure. You see, we haven't real. This is just the galactic background generally, and then individual sources don't start to appear until we get above a TeV. So the strongest limits up here are those Hess measurements. And there, you could have all kinds of magnetic focusing in the local geometries. I don't want to dwell on this. People do know stuff about the large scale and the local magnetic fields and the spiral arms and stuff. It'll just be here for reference in this. But you could have a situation where the sun is near a source and you have some local channeling of magnetic field that could connect us well to one of those pulsars. So that has to be taken into account. Even though on a large scale average, cosmic rays are diffusing and rattling around in these disordered fields, locally you could have some kind of magnetic channeling that would bring them.
Would that show up as an anisotropy?
It should. Yeah, there will be some scattering between us and there. So there might be a dipole anisotropy of flow past us.
Enough data?
There's no. Well, one of the problems is all the measurements are at a low enough energy still that the heliosphere around the sun with its magnetic fields distorts all that directionality. You have to go above a TeV before you begin to see anisotropies due to the local galactic magnetic field. It's just a cartoon of some pulsar spewing out particles. So I listed some cautions. I've mentioned many of these. Measuring electron spectra are very difficult. The spectra are steep and background rises with increasing energy. Magnetic fields are ubiquitous in the universe and they push particles around. They separate charges. Acceleration is common. Magnetic reconnection, for example, and its role is very poorly understood. So any of these effects can create some observed effects that you have to be thinking about. And the physics is messy. You know, you often get multiple explanations for the same observed phenomenon. And nature, the more we look into this, the more complex things tend to be. So those are all fairly obvious. The results, I think, are very interesting. This is particularly with respect to Pamela. The Pamela data look good to me. I can't find anything that I would quibble in what they've done. Let's see. We do need to rule out other sources. Maybe the LAT will help from GLAST, Fermi, now called Fermi. There's a lot of pulsar observations going on, modeling. And maybe our better understanding of the pulsars will help us to put constraints on how much contribution pulsars might make. Let's see. Well, and the acceleration of electrons is going on everywhere. Even the Earth's tail at different energies, of course, and Jupiter, we see electrons from Jupiter running around the solar system. So everything... It makes accelerated electrons, so be careful. We need I mentioned that, we need this e to the minus 2 spectrum. And in the handout, here's a list of some theoretical papers that discuss some of the possible implications, but you'll hear more about all that. And then at the back, I have some more details of the instrument, but I'm going to skip that and just leave that for the handout that you have a copy to pass around if anybody wants. So that's all. I guess I could have squeezed that in before lunch.
Do you want to comment about the data from, I think it's Kobayashi et al., the emulsion chamber data, and that it doesn't see a bump, and what your take on that?
The emulsion, those are just painstaking measurements of individual electron showers in an emulsion. And
does that lead you to trust it less, more, or just...
It's very hard. The statistics are very poor. And there may be some kind of selection biases because they don't... The spectrum is so steep, so they hunt for the big showers, and then they do analyze those, and then they look in a smaller section of the emulsion for smaller showers and so on. The measurements are probably pretty good. They can see the details of the shower starting, so they can. I think their background suppression should be pretty good.
It's a balloon thing.
They just put a big stack of emulsions into a balloon. Let it collect data and then scan them. That's not for me. It's for people who don't mind going blind at an early age. Okay, great. Well, this is a lot of fun. I'm sorry I have to run because I'm going to hear all the theory this afternoon. I'm going to miss that. I'm sorry about that. But we're going to Hawaii tomorrow, and the heck with you all.
By a show of hands earlier, there are probably about 10 theory papers coming out of this room. So you'll get a chance to read about it.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well, it certainly generated a lot of theoretical interest. And, but just take experiments with a good grain of salt. As long as there's no measurements, you're totally unconstrained. Go do your theory. Have fun. But actually, GLAST is going to produce some results that may knock out some of the phase space here pretty soon, I hope. Okay.